Michael Avery with Classic Business.
Welcome back to the show. I've got Professor Roman Parsons and Warwick Lucas in studio talking about what has been a very interesting week in South African politics, as the votes are pretty much now pointing to what the final number should indicate. Just to give you that number at this present stage, with around 94.5% of the votes captured, we have the ANC currently at 57.76%, the DA on 20.6%, and the EFF on 10.5. Now, that 10.5 needs to be seen in the context of 1.1 million votes that the EFF garnered in 2014. It's currently on 1.6 million, so it's gained 500,000 votes. The percentage increase is outsized because obviously we've had less people turning out to vote, so it certainly has received a boost from that. But I'd like to focus on the DA, Roman. A lot of people have been critical of a campaign that was One South Africa for All, and a message that tried to create a broad church, to borrow from the ANC terminology. If you look at where the DA has lost ground, clearly on the radical right, as it's called, the Freedom Front Plus. But the interesting numbers for me are contained in the township numbers in Gauteng, where we've seen sharp drops in support for the DA. Where to now for the DA after an election that'll be viewed by many as a failure?
Well, I think certainly they're going to have to do some very careful heart-searching about the future. You know, there are a number of what-ifs here. I mean, one purely sort of arithmetical one would be if circumstances had not favoured the development of the good party, you might have had 2 or 3 percentage points added to their 21 or 20%, whatever it is at the moment, and that could have made a difference, certainly. Think quite clearly the strategy of where you go from here is something that they'll have to address. It may be that seeking to be, as the phrase has it, all things to all people, that in fact diminishing returns had now set in, and that they will have to regroup and decide what their future strategy will be. I simply say that, speaking purely and in a non-party sense, we do want a strong opposition in South Africa. We do want a strong, if you want to call it a centrist group, which will uphold certain values which quite a few people share. But I think how you institutionalize it and how you strategize it, there will have to be a revision of that for the next local elections, and of course for the next general election. So quite clearly there were mistakes made, otherwise the numbers wouldn't be what they are now.
Warwick, there was an excellent thread, and I'm just going to direct listeners to it, by Ryan Kutsia, who dedicated 2 decades of his life to strategically directing the Democratic Alliance. And he goes through chapter and verse where he feels they went wrong. Where do you feel the DA went wrong?
Look, I think that, I mean, they did have a harder fight on their hands. I think they certainly have made a bit of a move to the left, which is a reasonably rational move. I think there's certain evolutions in the DA, and to be a party with a real support base in South Africa, you have to widen what kind of church you are. So I think that's that was a relatively reasonable move there. And then finally, I think the losses in the townships that you mentioned there, I mean, bear in mind that the EFF was a much smaller party than the last time that happened. And I think that there were protest votes that have since that got made there that simply got switched to the EFF rather, now that the EFF is a much stronger protest vote. And I mean, this has been an election of protest votes, going back to the state of the economy, whether it's job losses or just general political angst. I mean, the temperature has been quite high now since December 2017, and I think it's a natural evolution.
And of course, Michael, don't forget, we haven't yet said anything about the fact that the turnout was so low, and what message is that sending? Now, I think one can unpack that. There are a number of reasons which one can talk about. I think there's also a practical reason we mustn't overlook, and that is that the state of the economy is such that there are numbers of people, irrespective of whether they feel alienated or not, who simply cannot get to the polling booth to pay a taxi to take the time to walk to where they have to go. And there are a number of instances from an anecdotal point of view where it was simply an inability, a logistical inability, not being able to afford to be able to get to the vote. We don't realize that sitting around this particular microphone, but it's a very important factor, irrespective of the fact that there was an alienation factor and the youth factor and so forth. But I think what does that hold for the future? Can they be brought back? And if so, what are some of the issues that we need to address if we want a higher participation from the voters in our future elections?
Anecdotally, Raymond, I spoke to a few people who didn't vote because they couldn't get IDs or temporary IDs in time. Why? Because they couldn't take a full day of work to go and apply at Home Affairs. And that's what you have to do nowadays because Home Affairs is so dysfunctional. I agree with Peter Bruce on that being a very key appointment.
These are practical
to the
issues.
New cabinet.
Yes. It's not all at the high level, I'm alienated or I'm resisting my participation. They are practical issues of a bread and butter nature which are standing in the way of quite a large number of people being able to exercise their vote.
Right. Stay right there. We're going to talk about the role of the economic cluster as we wrap up our analysis of what has been a very interesting general election.
Michael Avery with Classic Business.
We've all experienced how much technology has changed every aspect of our personal lives, including our healthcare. If you consider how many connections there are between the millions of patients and the different healthcare providers, medical doctors, hospitals, medical aid schemes, and pharmacies, you will know that those connections are made possible by technology. Talk to the technology company that is busy transforming the healthcare sector, Altron. There, when it matters, visit altron.com for more information.
Michael Avery with Classic Business.
Welcome back to the show. It is now all about rubber hitting road for the president as he looks to assemble that cabinet, which will be announced towards the back end of May. So we won't have to wait too long for that, hopefully within the next 2 weeks. And the role of the economic cluster is going to become increasingly important. In fact, the number one focus, I think, for the market to ease the conditions of doing business. We had in the State of the Nation address a commitment to improve our ease of doing business ranking from the mid-80s, I think it was, to below 50. Raymond, what do you think is the key here for the market? Clearly, we need to see a consolidation of some ministries, and the talk already from Fikile and Balula is that the ANC as a party supports a reduction of the size of the cabinet. What else are you going to be looking for?
Well, I think the economic cluster is probably the combination that would be most important to the business community and to the markets. What impression does that create? What message does it send in terms of the targets and the commitments and the expectations that have been generated not only by the investment summit but also by the job summit? So we don't have to reinvent too many wheels. We can say this is what the economic cluster ought to be getting on with. Now, who is in that cluster? Finance, trade and industry. I've suggested one good step might be to change its name and call it the Department for Trade and Industry rather than of Trade and Industry. That might create a more friendly attitude. There, of course, is public enterprises and there's the Department of Labor. At least those are some of the important cluster. So clearly, in terms of what we said earlier, if we are to address whether it's what we're going to do about Moody's, what are we going to do about Eskom, what are we going to do about unemployment, we're still talking next week about a 1% growth rate for this year. That hasn't changed. But what has changed is the commitment that we want to shift it. We want to shift that needle sooner rather than later. So I think certainly those portfolios that we've mentioned and which we've discussed are going to be an important test of the commitment to pursuing the pro-growth reform policies that have been indicated, whether it's at the investment summit, job summit, all that is lying fallow there now. Now we've got to get on with it, and we've got to show the leadership that is necessary. Let me also say one thing is that when you have an election campaign, everything seems possible and everything seems affordable. There is going to be pain. There are going to be tough decisions that have to be taken. And I would simply say that, certainly coming back to the earlier point about who are your allies in this matter, it is common cause in most political cycles that if you have to take unpleasant, painful decisions, do them early on in the electoral cycle. If you're convinced they're right, that by the time you get to the end of the cycle, the benefits will be so apparent that everyone will have forgotten what the pain was to get the gain. And I think that's going to be an important test of the leadership and of the efficiency and the capacity of the economic cluster to win the confidence of business and investors.
Well, the art of leadership is to provide hope, hold on, pain ends. So if you do have pain in the beginning, hopefully it will end eventually. Warwick, what do you think the president's going to be focusing on in the construction of that cabinet?
Well, I think a certain amount of cohesiveness and obviously a focus on turnaround now. I mean, there's been a lot of pandering to different camps. And I think certainly what one would be looking for on the outside is that the pandering stops now.
It's, enough time for talking, enough time for soft, flowery rhetoric. It certainly is a time for action. But he is an action president. If you read about how he runs the NEC meetings, he doesn't lead from behind when it comes to those. Yes, he has been known to build consensus, but he's also one who, as Tito Mboweni says, reads the board minutes. He comes prepared and he comes with an idea and he's an executor. That's certainly what we need now. Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer of Galileo, and Raymond Parsons of Northwest University Business School, thank you so much for your analysis. We have to call it there in what has been a very entertaining election, for one that was so dry into the build-up.